Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Back in July, ExxonMobil once again reported the largest quarterly profit in U.S. history. They reported revenue of $138 billion in the second quarter alone. That works out to $1,485 per second. In 2006, Exxon gave Lee Raymond, its chairman, one of the most generous retirement packages in history, nearly $400 million plus bonuses. Riding on high oil and gas prices, the oil industry is far and away the most profitable and powerful industry in the world. ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Total took in over $167 billion in profits in 2006 alone. But according to today's guest, Antonia Juhas, big oil faces the greatest threat to its existence in its 150-year-plus history. Oil is growing far more difficult to come by. Antonia Juhas traces the story of big oil from the rise of John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company back in 1870. Back then, Standard Oil controlled 90% of all refineries here in the U.S., 80% of the marketing of oil products, and a quarter of the country's total crude output. But things have drastically changed since then, and we'll talk about that on the show today. We're happy to have Antonia back to discuss her new book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. Antonia is a fellow at the Petrocritic Organization, Oil Change International, and at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Antonia joins me here in studio. Hi, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So let's start off by talking about the latest news. On Friday, the price of oil tumbled more than 10% to its lowest level in more than a year. According to reports, a lot of traders are fearing that the economic crisis will kill demand for crude. Mm-hmm. How do you explain this drop?
Well, it's not just the drop. Let's look at the last week and a half. About a week and a half ago, we had the largest one-day run-up in the price of crude since crude has been being traded on futures markets. That one-day run-up, about $25 in one day, was attributed to a single energy trader. One guy sent all of the markets scurrying in chaos.
Well, how does that work?
Well, that's the nature of a deregulated exchange. So we have energy being traded completely outside of the purview of U.S. government regulators, such that one guy can manipulate the price. I mean, let's recall when oil surpassed $100 a barrel at the beginning of 2008, it was a lone energy trader that took the price up to $100. He framed the ticket. He went on television saying, I'm the guy who made oil reach $100 a barrel. And let's also remember that that's when the recession started. The recession began when oil reached $100 a barrel, when that impacted economies throughout the world, impacted our economy. That put us on the edge that we then felt, the cliff we fell off of with the subprime mortgage crisis. Now, the price has dropped, of oil has dropped down again, then it went back up again. This is the nature of volatile, unregulated markets. But it's a volatile, unregulated market, a speculative bubble, if you will, that is resting on top of the reality of the fact that at some point, although not today, we will live in a world where demand for oil exceeds supply. So it's a bubble built on a platform of a reality of a shortfall that will occur. So we're going to have volatility matched with, I argue, the price, you know, going up and up and up and up and up.
Right.
But our markets are going to get thrown into turmoil because this is such a unregulated market for the resource on which, you know, the global economy relies.
And you're really arguing that this cannot continue.
I certainly hope it doesn't continue. I mean, clearly, not only is it the same phenomena that we're talking about, the speculation of unregulated markets that impacted the subprime mortgage crisis, it's literally the same piece of legislation. It was the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that deregulated derivatives, subprime mortgage exchanges. It's the same piece of legislation that deregulated crude oil futures markets. So we're really looking at the same cause, and let's hope we're not looking at the same effect, because if we have the same type of crash in crude markets that we've had in the subprime market, the impact on the economy would be far worse.
And I want to make sure that we talk about this in ways we can all understand it, because there's just so much to this. There's so many layers. Now, in your book, you write that ExxonMobil, Chevron, Conoco, Shell, BP, and Marathon produce more crude on a daily basis than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
10.5 million barrels compared with 9.2 million. So just to kind of bring this close to home, you write about Chevron. So, for example, if the crude comes from a Chevron oil field, it's refined in a Chevron refinery, which is over in Richmond, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sold at a Chevron-owned gas station. Then a great deal of the decision-making over the cost and the profit is in Chevron's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there are no competitors along the way.
Not only is there a dearth of competition due to concentration and consolidation within the U.S. refining and marketing, that's gas stations markets, but these companies are what's called vertically integrated. So just as you laid out, the same company owns the oil in the field, at the refinery, at the pump, which means that, and this takes us from crude prices to gas prices, a great deal of the price decision-making, in fact, about 30% of the price, or 30 cents of every dollar of the price of oil at the pump, is fully in the hands of the oil company. And that's not even taking into consideration the amount of influence that the oil companies have on the price of crude. And that influence is exercised through the energy traders that work for the oil companies that are involved in the speculative markets, but also, as you say, the 13% of the world's oil that they control. Now, that's not as great an amount of oil as they controlled during the Seven Sisters glory years, which I describe in the book, from the end of World War I to the mid-70s when they owned all of the world's oil. That's not as powerful as OPEC once was when it owned the majority of the world's oil. But today we're in a world where OPEC only controls about 40% of the world's oil. China and Russia maintain large controls of oil, although they don't tend to work in concert. Then you have the oil companies with their 13% of the world's oil, which is enough of a sizable chunk, given those equations that I laid out, that it gives them a fair influence over price. But also those equations that I laid out have made it such that the futures market is now the dominant determinant of a price of a barrel of oil.
And there are no rules on that market.
On the primary market where crude oil is exchanged was a market set up by the banks and the oil companies. It's called the Intercontinental Exchange. It is unregulated in the United States.
You also argue that because, for example, when you drive down the street and you need a gallon of gas or a tank of gas, you see the Chevron, and sometimes you see smaller operations that maybe aren't familiar to you.
Mm-hmm.
But you're arguing that a number of those smaller operations are disappearing because they can no longer stay above water. Therefore, the only option you have is Shell or Chevron or, well, what else is in this area?
Conoco,
I don't buy gas on a very regular basis, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what's happened is that we've had 2,600 mergers in the oil and gas industry, 2,600 just since 1990.
Wow. So is Chevron buying up those smaller mom and pops that we see?
Past tense, has bought.
Has bought.
I mean, if I'd love for our callers to call in if they can actually point to an independent gas station somewhere and let everybody else know where it is, because there's basically none of them left.
Is it better to buy from an independent gas station?
Well, I don't drive either, but if you have to drive and you own a car, there's a couple rules of thumb in terms of where to choose to go. I would say first, support your independent gas stations if you can find one. At least you're helping the little guy. And basically, the bottom line is all the gas is the same. There's almost no difference in the gasoline that you're buying within a regulated state. So in California, we have a good regulations on having cleaner gasoline than most other states. Within this state, the gas is basically the same. Then some folks like to go to Citgo because that's the oil company owned by the Venezuelans, and people like to support the Venezuelans. The other way to go is Valero. The only thing that's good about Valero is that they don't produce oil, so at least you're one step removed from the human rights abuses that are endemic among the other large oil companies like Chevron, like Exxon, like Shell, in their production enterprises.
So if they don't produce it, where do they get it?
Well, then, so you're just sort it's of just it's chosen ignorance. You okay. don't know where it's coming from. So they're buying it from someone else, but they're not engaged in the process themselves.
Okay. Well, since you said ask the listeners, let's do that. Yeah. If you have a question for Antonia Juhas or just an overall comment about the oil industry, I mean, there's so many layers to this. And what we're going to do is talk about the profit making and also Antonia's argument that this cannot continue as is. We'll also talk about the green commercials that we're seeing from companies like Chevron. And then we'll also talk about the differences between the nationalized oil companies, the state-owned oil companies, versus the Chevrons and the Shells of the world. Mm-hmm. And the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Now, when it comes to the price, what sort of differences do you expect to see between now and election day?
Because the gas prices.
Yeah, this seems to always happen right around election time.
Yeah, I mean, this is a particularly interesting experience that we've had. Most often, one of the ways that we see the consolidation of gas and oil and refineries within the hands of the oil companies is a phenomenon known as rockets and feathers. So when the price of oil increases, the price of gas increases like a rocket, simultaneously shoots up, because they know that we know that the price is up and they can get away with it. Then when the price of oil comes down, the price of gasoline feathers slowly back down, and it takes a long time for it to get back to where it should naturally be. And I argue, and most people in the industry understand, that that's a consequence of consolidation and collusion in the industry. The Exxons, the Chevrons, the Conocos are, if we have to say the word, colluding on price. But what's happened in the last week is that the price of gasoline rocketed down. As soon as oil went down, gas prices went down. They didn't go down as far as they could have, but they went down very quickly. And I would argue that when we've got an industry, the oil and gas industry, that has thus far donated 75% of its money in this election to Republicans, 1.6 million to McCain Palin versus 400,000. And we'll get back to that in a second.
Yeah, if you're just joining us, I just want to let you know that we're speaking with Antonia Juhas, the author of The Tyranny of Oil, and you are listening to Your Call. Okay, sorry about that. So go over that again, the companies are giving to the Republicans.
Yeah, the oil and gas industry gives to Republicans. It's even more concentrated within the individual companies, about 80% of campaign giving for Chevron, and higher than that for Exxon, to Republicans. And McCain-Palin, 1.6 million so far in this election, just from the oil and gas industry, versus Obama's less than 400,000. Clearly works to the interests of McCain in this election for the economy to get more stabilized. Because as the shakeup in the economy has happened, support for Barack Obama has skyrocketed. And so I think it's an interesting phenomenon that the price of gas has fallen so precipitously, out of character, not uncharacteristically, just in time for the election.
And then also, and we'll talk about this after the break, last time you were on, we talked about the Democrats caving to pressure from the Republicans by allowing the quarter-century ban on drilling for oil off the Atlantic and Pacific coast to expire. And it's expired now. So are we going to see drilling off the coast of the Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, it's Chevron that led the lobbying effort on this. Chevron is eager to drill in one place, California's offshore waters. We can definitely, I mean, unless we act, that's definitely their plan to start drilling more aggressively off California's shores.
All right. And coming up after the break, we're going to find out what exactly that means, what's allowed, what kind of rules do they have to follow or not follow nowadays. And then also, Obama did change his view on that, on that rule by letting it expire. We're speaking today with Antonia Juhas. She is out with a new book called The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. And if you have a question or a comment for Antonia, if you have a question that maybe you just don't understand because there's just so many layers to the oil industry, give us a call. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
And you're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, 91.7. The time is 11:20. Coming up at 12 o'clock, news and notes. At 1 o'clock, it's Radio Nation with Laura Flanders. And at 2 o'clock, African Perspective, followed by One Planet. Both programs from the BBC World Service, right here on your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Sandeep Roy will have a conversation with Tom Butler and Chris Tompkins. They're authors of a new beautiful book. It's called Wildlands Philanthropy, The Great American Tradition. The book celebrates natural landmarks by introducing us to incredible people who really transferred privately owned land to the public trust and made much of our park system possible today. So be sure to tune in for that tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with Van Jones about his new book, The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable where we connect you with reporters to talk about coverage of the week's news. And if you have a show idea for us or an overall comment, please drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. But today we are happy to welcome Antonia Juhas back to the show. She's out with a new book called The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. Antonia is a fellow at Oil Change International and at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I also wanted to let you know that she'll be reading tonight at Moe's Books over in Berkeley at 7:30. Tomorrow she'll be in Santa Cruz at Bookshop Santa Cruz at 7:30. She's very busy. And then Thursday, she'll be at Borders here in San Francisco at 7. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. If you have a general question about oil, whether it's the price of oil, how the oil companies work, also, I'd love to know, how do you make decisions about where you buy gas? 866-798-8255. Before we get to calls, just briefly, I wanted to spend a little more time talking about drilling for oil off the Pacific. So Chevron wants to drill in California. What can we expect to see? What are their plans?
Well, I think just, you know, a continuation of what we're seeing in the Gulf. So if we want to know what's in store for California at Chevron's hands, we just need to look in the Gulf to see the impacts there. And we've seen the Gulf is the one area that was allowed, one of the areas where drilling was allowed to continue after the moratorium was passed. And essentially, we've seen an explosion of drilling in the Gulf area. Massive investments by the oil companies, more and more platforms, and of course, more and more accidents. Just with Hurricane Ike, the most recent hurricane, 500,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean because of offshore platforms being removed from their moorings, which is what happens when storms come through. These are incredibly expensive, technologically amazing platforms, but you know, they're still out in the ocean and they're still in the wake of storms. We also can expect a lot more drilling because one of the things we know about offshore drilling, for example, in the Gulf, which is where we have the most experience, 80% of the holes that are drilled offshore are dry holes in the Gulf. So you have to drill 10 holes to get 2 to yield you any oil at all. So that means we can expect a lot of drilling. And what that also means we can expect is a lot more release of methane, the worst climate-causing chemical out there, because any hole drilled beyond 500 feet into the ground offshore releases methane. So we've got these you have to drill lots and lots and lots of holes. They're all going to release methane, and they're all going to require platforms. And those platforms, again, you know, prone to accidents, prone to blowouts, prone to drifting hundreds of miles offshore.
Yeah, I mean, I just think about the oil spill that we had in the bay last year and how much destruction that caused.
Right, and that was from a tanker. And, of course, the more platforms you have, the more you have to have pipelines that go back and forth, ships that go back and forth. I mean, there's lots of energy required just to maintain the platforms and the drilling facilities as well.
So when can we expect to see these? When does Chevron want to begin this?
You know, I'm not sure what Chevron's plans are. I know that I quote Chevron throughout the book as talking about the need to start drilling offshore, the need to move into California. They've been lobbying for this. I don't know if they're ready to just jump out the gate and start drilling. Let's hope not, and let's hope that we have an opportunity to hold it at bay.
And then according to the government numbers, we should repeat this as many times as we can, we're not going to see any of this oil for, what, 10 years?
The Bush administration says at least 10 years before offshore drilling would yield any sizable quantities of oil.
And then there's also questions about whether it'll stay in the U.S. or go overseas.
Yeah, sure. So since 2006, U.S. oil companies, and let's remember, the largest producers of oil in the United States are, and this is not in order, BP, Shell, Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, and Occidental. These are global companies. So since 2006, they've been increasing the amount of oil and gasoline products that they export out of the United States because they can make more money for it. And because we have an excess supply of crude stocks, that's oil sitting in barrels in the United States, more than they know what to do with. So what they're doing with it is exporting it out. So, of course, drill here, drill now doesn't say anything about what happens with that oil once you've drilled it out.
All right, let's hear from our first caller. Let's go to Barbara in San Francisco. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate your show.
Thank you.
And it's more of a comment than a question, beginning with the credit default swaps in the market and what your guest has just said about the increase of prices and the increase of supply and the futures. The plague of the 21st century is gambling, and that is what each of these elements are doing, gambling, mm-hmm. and throwing everyone's money away.
Mm-hmm.
The plague of the 21st century, gambling, mm-hmm. and we should start saying the word gamble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a great book written by John Cavanaugh of the Institute for Policy Studies, written 25 years ago, called The Casino Economy, predicting 25 years ago that this would happen with financial markets, that we were creating a casino, that we were creating a pure gambling environment. And I quote in the book Enron energy traders talking about their manipulation of the California market, talking about calling themselves kids in a playground, playing without rules, playing with our, you know, lives, our economy, our future, and as you say, you know, creating a plague upon us. It's an excellent word.
And do you think this is going to change at all, considering what we're dealing with right now? I mean, before the show started, Antonia said that she was even weary of using the word nationalize in her book. And lo and behold, look what's happening.
The Bush administration is nationalizing the banks. Yeah, the whole world's turned on its head. We are in an incredibly a moment filled with possibilities. And I start the book with a hopeful chapter, which is looking at the success of the populist movements in fundamentally changing the relationship in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s between citizens and corporations in the United States. An incredibly analogous moment to where we are right now, where we have Senator McCain, Governor Palin, talking like turn-of-the-century populists. Why are they doing that? Because we're in the same economic moment where corporations have gained a financial and political hold on our country. But we've been here before. The populist movements before, what many people were seeking revolution at the time, what they got was regulation. We regulated the first campaign finance laws, the 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week, child labor laws, and antitrust laws. We're in the analogous moment where the potential for, you know, if not revolution, most certainly regulation is there. It's on the table, and we need to move aggressively to capture it.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Barbara. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Good morning, John.
Hi, Antonia.
Good morning.
Hi. First of all, I've heard you several times, and I've always been very impressed with your book and also what you have to say.
Thank you.
Years ago, I was very overwhelmed by a movie, which I'm sure you're familiar with, called The Formula, starring Marlon Brando, which was interesting, but it was rumored that it was squashed by Hollywood.
I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, well, I suggest you rent it as soon as possible. It was not only an excellent thriller, the basic premise was about how the Germans tried to turn water into oil.
Ah.
This fantasy. But the movie was very revealing because it talked about how the power of the oil industry and how it was turning into a cartel, which is exactly what it has done, as you've pointed out so clearly. I'd like to sort of state on that point where you notice that years ago, the major networks used to air commercials for the oil companies. Well, they no longer exist because they have a complete cartel and are in complete control, and they don't have to compete with one another anymore. So you may see them, their advertisements for Masterpiece Theater on PBS, but you'll never see a commercial for them where they're trying to compete for you to buy Exxon as opposed to Atlantic Richfield or something like this?
Well, let me. Well, first of all, Atlantic Richfield no longer exists. That's ARCO. ARCO was bought up by BP, so it's even more concentrated than one might imagine. Let me beg to differ, because there's a new phenomena that is just starting, which is the oil industry once again, and it hadn't for a very long time, just as you say. Advertising, massive advertising, not only on television, but I've been shocked to be walking around town and now seeing these Chevron advertisements, huge advertisements with smiling, happy Chevron people living in the green, wonderful Chevron land that are appearing everywhere. And I was just in Washington, D.C. These advertisements are billboard size in D.C. Chevron is eager for us to believe that they are clean, green, conscientious company. And there is a lot of reason for that. One is Chevron and all of the oil companies want us to think two things. One, when we fill up our gas tanks with Chevron oil, with Chevron gasoline, we might as well be donating $100 to Communities for a Better Environment, because Chevron is a green energy company. And by using their gasoline, you're actually doing something good for the environment. And they want you to think that. Number two, they want you not to go to your elected officials and lobby your elected officials and say, we need to tax this industry. We need to eliminate its subsidies. Huh. We need to take that money and invest it in alternative energy. Because Chevron will say, we are doing that already, so you don't need to force us to do it. We're a conscientious company, and we're doing those investments ourselves. Now, first point, they're not. So one of the most entertaining segments of this book for myself and my research assistant, Sam Edmondson, was to go through the tax returns of all of the oil companies and to look at exactly how much are they spending on green energy. And believe me, this was far more difficult than you might imagine it would be to actually get these numbers. As best as I could get the numbers, and because I couldn't get them very well, even from the tax returns, I made overestimates. So gave the oil companies the benefit of the doubt in many, many categories. The best and the highest expenditure on green energy was BP, and that was 4% of its total expenditures on green energy. Chevron in 2006, less than 2% of its total expenditures on green energy. Now, first of all, the companies don't want you to know that. The rest of the companies, 2%, 0.5%, 0 for Exxon in 2006.
And when you say green energy, what do you mean?
I mean solar, wind, geothermal, actual clean, renewable energy. Also investments in biofuels, also investments in hybrids. I mean, I'm giving them everything that I would consider, or most of us would consider, a green alternative,
right?
Even if it's just an R&D investment in something that might yield something in the future. So I was being very generous, and I delineated in the book exactly what I'm counting as there are green alternatives. But for Chevron in particular, this is a very important moment in time. Chevron is facing three major lawsuits right now that it really wants us to view them with a good eye. I'll just highlight them very quickly. The first is the government of Ecuador is about to rule on a massive lawsuit against Chevron for massive toxic oil spills across Ecuador, a $16 billion judgment that is about to be made. If it is made against Chevron, Chevron's going to try to argue that what happens in Ecuador stays in Ecuador and they don't have to pay up. The other case coming to trial on October 27th in San Francisco, mass human rights abuse charges against Chevron in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have Nigerians here every day in court explaining the harm that Chevron has done to them and their communities, a very big public relations problem for Chevron, and they want us to look at them with a good light. The third, in Richmond, the community of Richmond just launched a lawsuit to try and stop Chevron from retooling its refinery to burn dirtier crude in Richmond. Earth Justice, Communities for a Better Environment, suing the Richmond City Council for approving Chevron's plan. So Chevron needs us to think that they're a good company. That's why they're spending so much money on this advertising.
So, but they're still spending less than 4% of their expenditures.
Less than 4% on green energy at the same time as they're expanding their investments in the dirtiest production yet that humans have come up with, tar sand production in Alberta, shale production in the United States, and offshore production.
You brought up taxing, and in your book you write about one of the most expensive ballot measures ever fought in U.S. political history was California's Prop 87 on the November 2006 state ballot that would have taxed oil companies.
Yes.
Historically speaking, how have oil companies been taxed? Has it changed much over the years?
Well, there have been a number of boondoggles, I would say, that the industry has used to get favorable taxation within the United States that I go through in the book. But one of the, I think, most interesting for us here in California is the lack of taxation. So we are the third largest oil producing state in the country, yet we do not tax companies when they remove oil from the ground. Now, let's remember, we have a Chevron based here, Occidental based here. We have a Sera, which is a joint venture between Exxon and Shell based here. We are also in, you know, a $7 billion default as a state. One of the reasons why we're in that position is that we won't tax our companies. We won't tax the wealthy here. So we tried to introduce a teeny tiny little tax on the richest companies in the history of the world when they take our oil, and we were unable to do so. And I actually really loved telling the story in the book because of the power of the industry.
It's really amazing. Antonia writes that in total, oil companies spent over $100 million to defeat Prop 87, a local issue in a single state, and they succeeded. Mm-hmm. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking today with Antonia Yuhas about her new book, The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. And if you have a question or a comment for Antonia, feel free to give us a call. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Craig in San Leandro. Hi, Craig. Thanks for holding.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, bringing up Prop 87, you know, I thought it was ironic. I read your first book about the Bush agenda, and, you know, you mentioned the PSA that the oil companies were seeking in Iraq, the profit-sharing agreement. I always thought that Prop 87 was a lot like a profit-sharing agreement, and the oil companies were eager to get that in Iraq, yet in California they were fighting it tooth and nail. You know, but... one of the things I wanted to mention was that, you know, they could almost do a parody on those Chevron ads. I mean, we could do that guy's same
Let's
sort
do it.
Of voice.
Let's do it.
List, you know, put it on YouTube or something like that. One thing that Chevron doesn't put into that ad, which I find is really ironic, is they control the batteries for plug-in cars. And they only sell those in bulks of something like 10,000. So they don't want to sell those things. They want to control the development of those things. And there's a country called Cobasis, which is in the Midwest somewhere, which makes those, but Chevron controls that company. And, you know, that seems to me like it could be a real big issue with consumers, the fact that they're, you know, sort of stifling the development of plug-ins at the same time.
That's interesting. I do think one thing that has been interesting in the testimony of oil company executives lately and in their shareholder reports and in their even in their advertisements is that they are increasing a focus on conservation, trying to talk about energy efficiency, reduction of use. And I actually think that there is that they are interested in conservation for one reason. You know, they know that there's a limited supply of oil, that we're dwindling. And if they want to stay oil companies, which they very clearly do intend to stay oil companies, they're going to need the oil to last for a while. So I actually believe them in this new focus that they're taking on, which is that they are interested in people maybe consuming a little less, maybe being a little more energy efficient, so that the resource that their businesses depend on might last a little bit longer.
Well, and I'm looking at the Chevron website right now, and it says the power of human energy, finding newer, cleaner ways to power the world. At Chevron, we recognize the world needs all the energy we can develop in every potential form.
That's right. So this is the bottom line. I mean, I think the message that I that I took home from writing my book that was, I think, the most powerful for me, was that regardless of what they say in their propaganda and their minuscule investments, they intend to comb every inch of the planet to get every last drop of oil. And that is that Chevron says it right there on their website. They say it in their testimony. They say it to their shareholders. They'll get every last drop. Now, we know that there are consequences to that, that there are environmental consequences, militarized consequences. Of course, a whole chapter of the book on military and oil, and, you know, needing to go head to head, essentially, with other countries of the world to if we're going to a fight to the death to get what's left of the world's oil. And that's just not a path that I think most of us want to follow the oil industry down.
What do you mean by that exactly? And can you explain how that differs from the methods that will be used by state-owned oil companies in places like China and Russia and the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no simple solution to this problem. And I did not propose nationalization for a number of reasons. One of the reasons why I didn't propose nationalization was I am just not trustworthy enough at this stage in my life. And I've worked for two members of Congress. It's not like I haven't put in time and energy into the U.S. government. I am just not trustworthy enough, particularly of this current administration, nor of what I see in future administrations, to put control of our oil resources and oil decision making into the hands of our government. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, state governments have not necessarily proven themselves to be state ownership of oil of oil fields has not necessarily proven itself in the world to be a panacea to any of the problems, you know, that I'm talking about. The Chinese are an excellent example. The Chinese government, Chinese owned oil companies, you know, going to the ends of the earth, supporting some of the worst governments in the world, providing arms, doing whatever they can to get as much oil as they can. That's a state owned government. It's not as if that is any sort of panacea.
Well, when you bring up that issue, are there major differences between, say, China and then Chevron? the China-owned oil companies and Chevron.
Well, boy, that's a very interesting question. I can't just respond without thinking about it more fully. I mean, there in many ways it's apples and oranges. But there are many similarities. So you know, the charges that Chevron is under for its mass human rights abuses in Nigeria are, I would say, very similar to those that the Chinese government is being accused of in Darfur for its support of the Sudanese government. So very interesting question. Definitely something to think on further.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Craig. And let's hear from Kevin in Berkeley.
Hi
Kevin.
Good morning. I love the discussion this morning. I've always supported small gas stations. I have small banks, small gas stations I support rather than big ones. Sometimes the smaller companies, the smaller gas stations are cheaper, but sometimes they're more expensive. Can you talk about how that happens?
That's a great question. There used to be independent refineries and independent gas stations, and the independent refineries would charge less money for their refined gasoline to the gas station, and then the independent gas station could charge less to you and I. Well, what's happened now with the concentration of the refinery sector is that the Chevrons, the Exxons, the Shells control the refining and control the wholesale price of gas. So they control how much they charge to any gas station that wants to buy their oil. And most often the independent gas stations are still getting their gasoline from a Chevron refinery. So basically the Chevron refinery has refined as much gasoline as it can for its own stations. What's left over, it will sell to an independent gas station. But they're charging very high, oftentimes higher wholesale prices to the independent gas station than they're charging to their own gas stations, which makes the independent gas station have to pay an even higher price for gasoline. And this is just, you know, a concentrated market that nobody's regulating. You know, essentially, you've got a lot of rules on the books. They're not being enforced. You're not allowed, I mean, the pricing mechanisms that are being used by the industry at the gas stations, at the refineries, are completely, you know, fly in the face of antitrust law, and they're being permitted. And that's one of the reasons why it's even harder now for independent gas stations to charge you less.
You point out that this is the first administration we've had that's basically full of oil men and one oil woman, Condoleezza Rice. Is what we're seeing, or is what we've seen in the past 8 years, different from what we saw in the Clinton administration, for example?
Yeah, in many respects. I mean, I was working for the government during the Clinton administration, by no means an administration beyond reproach. In fact, the Clinton administration, you know, really took the antitrust philosophy of the Reagan administration and went even further, allowing more mergers, you know, certainly took corporate globalization policy to new heights, lots of problems with that administration. But in terms of this industry, just a very different approach to the oil and gas industry than the Bush administration. We're really, the only historical comparison I could come up with is the Harding administration. If anyone's familiar with the Teapot Dome scandal, that's the really the only comparison. When we had Andrew Mellon, the head of Gulf Oil, as the Treasury Secretary for three administrations. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only comparison that I can make to what to a historical precedent to the Bush administration. We've just seen laws rewritten, laws not followed, wars fought. I mean, you know, I argue in the book on behalf of this industry, and that's because this administration is part and parcel to this industry.
All right. Thanks again for calling in, Craig. And let's hear from Tim, who is driving, I believe, in the Bay Area. Hi, Tim.
Hi. How you doing?
Good thanks.
Morning. A very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
I have a question. I know, so I chimed in when you were talking about drilling and really not in favor of drilling. The way I see it is I think we need a concerted effort in all sources of energy to meet the energy demands going forward. And I wanted to get the guest's perspective on nuclear power. And are the oil companies that all contributing or investing into nuclear power? Because I think nuclear power is going to be a major solution to the issues that we have going forward.
Thanks for your question. You know, first of all, my number one solution to this problem that we're in is reduced consumption. At the end of the day, we just can't maintain the lifestyle that we have, the consumptive lifestyle that we have, and we certainly cannot continue to lead by the example that we're setting for the rest of the world to follow. And that has to be the bottom line. There's no energy solution out there that would allow us to continue to consume the amount that we're consuming, but just replace it with another form of energy. So we have to reduce. Then I think we need to look at local solutions, small scale solar, wind, green jobs to put into place those alternatives, public transit using green energy. I am not an advocate of nuclear power because of the, you know, we just simply don't have the technology to deal with the waste, and we don't have any way of making sure that it's safe. But we are leaving for generations to suffer the consequences of our consumption if we switch wholeheartedly to nuclear now. And I don't feel comfortable doing that to my children and grandchildren. Oil industry is not investing in nuclear. What they are investing in is coal. So Chevron owns a coal facility. A number of the companies do. You know, this is another huge source of energy in the United States, and we do see them diversifying into that industry. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing both candidates support this absolute mythical conception of the concept of clean coal. It's just to get money from the coal industry and the oil industry.
Well, Tim, thank you for calling in. And you actually, I've been wanting to do a show about nuclear power, so I'll bring it up today at the meeting. Thanks for calling in. And then just briefly, reduce consumption. We don't hear these words from politicians at all. It's you can drill your way out of the problem. Based on what you've looked at in terms of Obama's energy plan, if he does win in less than 3 weeks, do you think that he will take on the oil industry? And do you think that he'll start talking about these solutions that you mentioned?
His policies are definitely superior to those of McCain. So what I like about what he says is that he is looking at taxation, increasing taxation on corporations and the wealthiest among us. We need that. We need an administration that will look at eliminating the subsidies to the oil industry, taxation to the oil industry, tax breaks to the oil industry. He has talked about a windfall profits tax on the oil industry.
And he'll probably need a majority Senate and House to do this.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
But you think he will have the political will to take on these companies? Because right now it's the buzzword, right? Everybody's sort of talking about these greedy corporations. But
yeah. He's been talking about the oil industry for a while, actually. Yeah. The title of my book, The Tyranny of Oil, comes from an Obama speech where he, when he accepted the win at the Iowa caucus, he announced in his acceptance speech that he, and this is one sentence, he would be the politician, he didn't say politician, he would be the person who ends the tyranny of oil once and for all and ends the war in Iraq. And that was the one sentence that he said. Now, he has not demonstrated that he will, in fact, end the war in Iraq. He doesn't have a plan for that. He doesn't have a bold plan for taking on the industry in the ways that I would like to see it taken on. At the end of the day, that responsibility is ours. And it's our responsibility to hold him if he wins. And, you know, I'm not speaking for my organizations. I'm speaking for myself. I support him. But it's up to us to ensure that the changes that we want to see that happen on a policy level, on a consumptive level, happen after the election, regardless of who's in office.
Okay, and we just got an email from Running Elk, who said that we stated that the last major oil spill was a tanker, and he or she wanted to say it was a cargo ship.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the correction. I didn't even catch that, but you're right. The Costco Busan,
I believe
it was, right?
Yeah.
And we're still paying the price for that a year later.
Oh, yes. That's the other thing to remember. Oil can't be removed once it's been spilled. We have no mechanism for removing oil from water. Also, on the excellent point about the formula, the movie The Formula, which I'm definitely going to see, which talks about water, advocates of water privatization, more extreme water privatization, also talk about trading water on futures markets. Another thing to be scared of for the future.
All right. Well, thanks for the other show idea. Okay, let's hear from Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph. Thanks for holding.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I want to say it's going to be all but impossible to say what I really need to say in no more than 2 minutes. But I just wanted to say, when Ms. Uthouse appeared on your call on September 25th, at about 23:23 to 23:30 into the show, I called and challenged Ms. Uthouse's claim that the war in Iraq was and is all about oil. And she also made alternative statements that the war in Iraq was preeminently about war. And in her book, she made the statement that it was the one solid motivation to go to war in Iraq. So first of all, I would like to say that since you often ask for guest ideas, you should have Dahlia Waspy on your show, who's been a guest on your show before.
Right.
And people know that, some people may know that Dr. Dahlia Waspy, W-A-S-F-I, is a Jewish Iraqi American, an anti-war activist and international public speaker. And her website is at liberatethis.com. Anyway, Dahlia would disagree with Ms. Uthouse that the war in Iraq was preeminently about war. And she has a number of YouTube videos, and the one relevant to this conversation is call here is
Joseph, if you can email me those links,
sure,
I'll be happy
sure.
to put them up after the show.
Certainly.
And sorry to cut you off, but do you have a question, because we're almost out of time?
I'll be quick.
Okay.
So her YouTube video related to this is Israel Firsters, the greatest danger, and she has and she claims that Israel was at least
Joseph. Do you have a question, because I have to cut off in about a minute?
Okay. Well, since Ms. Uthouse's colleague at the I'm trying to rush myself.
Institute for Policy Studies.
Institute for Policy Studies, Phyllis Bennis, says that the only people really pushing for a war on Iran is the Israel lobby. And since Ms. Uthouse failed to answer my question before about material evidence for the war in Iraq, and since her book chapter about that, which I read, Chapter 8, Big Oil Plans, Wars for Oil, contains some real intellectual, logical, analytical, political, and historical lapses in that chapter, in which she uses only tangential claims to assert her assertion. And I would say assertions without material evidence.
All right, Joseph, sorry to cut you off, but we have to get a response. We're almost out of time.
Yeah, no, I mean, thank you for bringing up those concerns and those issues. You know, my colleague Phyllis Bennis and I are very strong supporters of each other's work, and I think if we brought her on the show, I think we could have a really interesting conversation about the points that you're making for her. But you know, I appreciate your analysis and your close reading of the book, and I just encourage other folks to do the same. And you know, please read it, give me your critiques, and you know, I really appreciate your close reading of my work.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Joseph. We're speaking with Antonia Juhas, and you can find more information about her book and also her readings at yourcallradio.org. And we have time for just a few more callers. Let's hear from Matt in Oakland. Hey, Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I guess first just wanted to ask what Ms. Juhas would recommend as far as action on behalf of citizens who are interested in kind of making good on the recommendations she puts forth as far as changing the dynamics that exist that empower the oil industry. The other thing I quickly wanted to ask was, it kind of surprises me sometimes, too, that the oil interests and those in power who kind of support their dominance don't put a greater emphasis on kind of prolonging the dominance of oil by either raising the price or other means because of the very useful purposes that oil can serve in certain sectors of the economy. You know, there are things like lubricants and other things that come from oil which are not easily replaced by other, or jet fuel or something like that, that are not easily replaced by alternative fuels. So it sometimes surprised me that there's not more emphasis on prolonging oil's lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks,
Matt. Yeah, excellent point. So thank you. What we can do about it. So the first is in the Bay Area, there's a number of local issues to get involved in Richmond, a number of measures and struggles against, you know, a local community going head to head with Chevron. So please look at the websites of Communities for a Better Environment and West County Toxics Coalition to see how you can help there. Also with the Nigeria trial against Chevron, there's a group, Justice for Nigeria Now. Their website is chevrong.org, and you can help them out there. Looking at Chevron in Ecuador, a wonderful group, Amazon Watch. One of the things I try to do in the conclusion chapter to the book is not just present alternatives that I have, but to really name and link readers to all of the amazing groups doing such great work at the local, national, and international level on these issues so you can get involved. But real quick, here's my call. The separation of oil and state. Get oil money out of elections, out of our candidates. Get them to renounce all oil industry money, and we all pledge to vote for the least oily candidate out there.
All right. Antonia Juhas, her book is The Tyranny of Oil. She'll be at Moe's Books over in Berkeley tonight and at Bookshop Santa Cruz tomorrow, Borders in San Francisco on Thursday. Antonia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for all of your calls. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. How can we save the wilderness for public use? On the next Your Call, we'll be joined by Tom Butler and Chris Tompkins, authors of Wildlands Philanthropy, The Great American Tradition. The book celebrates natural landmarks by introducing us to the people who transferred privately owned land to the public trust and made much of our park system possible. These are extraordinary people who simply loved the land. How can we work together to carry on their legacies? It's Your Call with Sandeep Roy and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find a link to the Your Call podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
The San Francisco Office of Emergency Services is conducting its weekly test of San Francisco's 49 air warning sirens. The test occurs every Tuesday at 12 noon and lasts approximately 30 seconds. The system is maintained by the City and County of San Francisco to alert residents to turn on the radio in the event of emergencies, such as a hazardous material spill or tsunami waves. If you hear the sirens at any other time than Tuesday at 12 noon, tune to 91.7 KALW for emergency instructions and information. This is KALW San Francisco. And coming up next, it's news and notes, followed at 1 o'clock by Radio Nation. 2 o'clock, it's African Perspective, and at 2:30, One Planet, followed by a full hour of news from the BBC at 3, and from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, as it happens, at 4 o'clock. This is KALW, San Francisco. The time is 12 o'clock.